Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to INSS special podcast today commemorating Holocaust Remembrance Day. 79 years have passed since the gravest chapter in Jewish history has come to its tragic end, in which 6 million Jewish men, women, children, and elderly perished in the biggest, most monstrous industrial genocide known in human history, the Holocaust. Jews from across Europe and North Africa were first marked, separated from their neighbors, from the societies in which they lived, which they considered their own, concentrated in ghettos and camps, were dehumanized, and in the end, murdered, gassed, and burned by the Germans and their accomplices in almost every single country in Europe and parts of North Africa. All of this happened because of one reason only. They were Jews. The so-called final solution, the German Nazi grand plan to which there was no precedent in human history, to annihilate every single living Jew, marked a new chapter in history. A chapter which tells us how evil people can become if only certain conditions take place, but it also tells us how good other people can become in such extreme situations. Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, is commemorated in Israel each year. The date chosen for the commemoration is the 27th of the month of Nisan in the Hebrew calendar, commemorating Jewish heroism in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in April 1943, and reminding us that heroism was actually everywhere, not only in the ghettos of Jews holding pistols, but also in the very last moments of breath in the gas chambers and in the death pits. This year signifies a special and even greater difficulty to address the topic of Holocaust remembrance and the singularity of the tragedy after the vicious and barbaric massacre of more than 1,400 Jewish Israeli men, women, children, and elderly on the 7th of October by Hamas terrorists. 76 years after the establishment of the State of Israel, the national home of all Jews around the world, Jews were slaughtered, raped, beheaded, burned alive, and were taken hostage from their own homes. On October 2023, Jewish lives once again were in danger, this time on Israeli soil. How to address the issue of Holocaust memory and commemoration in the shadow of the massacre of October 7th by Hamas? Where do these two tragedies, traumatic historical events in Jewish history, meet, and where do they differ? Why is it so important to see and acknowledge the differences between the events and to be aware of dangerous comparisons? And last, but of course not least, how do Jews around the world feel at a time of such an alarming rise in anti-Semitism after October 7th? I'm Adi Kanto, and in order to discuss these questions in depth, I'm honored to have next to me in the INSS studio today, Michal Kotler-Wunsch, Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism. Michal is a prominent public speaker, researcher, and independent policy and strategy advisor on intersecting issues of anti-Semitism, law, human rights, and Zionism. She explores topics surrounding mutated and mainstream rising anti-Semitism and the threat of disinformation and conspiracy theories to democracies. Michal was also a member of the Israeli 23rd Knesset from 2020 to 2021. A very warm welcome to you, Michal. Thank you very much for joining me in this very special talk today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Adi.
Michal, so many questions on the table. We address two tragedies today. On the one side, Holocaust Remembrance Day. On the other side, the massacre of October 7th. And I would like to first maybe tackle the issue, maybe first from a personal perspective, personal point of view. Today, in April 2024, where does Holocaust memory meet you? So, if you have a picture or a text in mind, what do they represent to you today, this year?
So this year, Adi, and I think that it wasn't random, that the intergenerational trauma of the Holocaust was elicited on 10/7. The mechanisms that were utilized, the war crimes and the crimes against humanity perpetrated by a genocidal terror proxy of a murderous authoritarian regime that perpetrated, as you said, those war crimes and crimes against humanity, burning alive, raping, massacring, beheading, mutilating and abducting, taking hostage an entire people with that intergenerational trauma, if you ask me to envision what it is that we try to convey, and actually I felt it this year very clearly because we just marked Passover, mm-hmm. thousands of years of Jewish history, and I'll say this a few times during our podcast, a prototypical indigenous people. That mm-hmm. is what Jews are. Why prototypical? Mm-hmm. Because Jews speak the same language and read the same book and traverse the same land and practice the same customs and rituals for thousands of years. And it's critical that we recognize that moment of indigeneity. And we just read the Haggadah. And never before have I understood the words of the Haggadah so clearly. In that same way, the pictures that we have in our minds of 10/7, whether it's the 47-minute movie that some of us have had to see, too brutal to imagine, but not too terrible to have happened. The understanding of that intergenerational trauma is what challenges us at our core, but it is a call to action and responsibility. And I want to say that the most important thing from those pictures in my own mind, in terms of the Holocaust, is understanding that the Holocaust, in very many ways, in people's minds, was justification, if you will, for the creation of the state of Israel. But we have to ensure that we reverse that paradigm. Mm-hmm. The state of Israel doesn't exist because the Holocaust occurred. It's precisely the opposite. The Holocaust could not have occurred had the state of Israel existed. And that is what we go back to in terms of that indigeneity. And I just referred to the mm-hmm. Passover story. Mm-hmm. The state of Israel exists as Israel's Declaration of Independence clearly stipulates, as the nation state of a prototypical indigenous people returned after thousands of years of exile and persecution, the height of which, or the peak of which, was the Holocaust. Yeah. But the Holocaust is not the justification, if you will, the reparation prize for the murder of 6 million Jews. And that is where we are not only at a moment of great challenge, but at a moment of tremendous opportunity and responsibility to ensure that we make accessible that never again for us, the Jewish people, never again for the Jewish nation state, means never again will we enable the process that enabled the atrocities of the Holocaust, the dehumanization that you mentioned, the delegitimization of Jews' very right to exist, mm-hmm. the marking, mm-hmm. and the double standards, whether the individual Jew, that thousands of years hatred, anti-Semitism, Jew mm-hmm. hatred that has actually survived by mutating mm-hmm. over thousands of years, exactly. latching on to the guiding social construct of the time, religion, science, and in our time, the secular religion of human rights. Mm-hmm. And we understand now that the dehumanization and the delegitimization and the double standards, that is the mechanism, whether it is utilized to bar the individual Jew mm-hmm. from an equal place in society, which it was in the past and is again today, mm-hmm. or if it is utilized to bar the Jewish nation state from an equal place in the family of nations, mm-hmm. in international institutions, on university campuses, on the streets.
You just mentioned university campuses. We record this podcast on a day, I'm sure that our viewers and listeners are aware of what's happening right now in the University of Columbia. It's just the pictures coming from there are just unimaginable. What Jewish students have to endure just by walking into, just wanting to come to class, wanting to walk into the campus, their lives are in danger as we speak this moment. It's just unimaginable. But we'll get to that. How do you see, Michal? You know, there have been since October 7th, there have been some comparisons, in my view, also dangerous comparisons between what had happened on that day and between the Holocaust. When we're talking about the Holocaust, we're talking about an event that happened for years. October 7th was a tragic event, murder that happened on one day. The comparisons, there are similarities concerning, for example, the barbarism, the murder, the massacre, the brutality, the evil. This you see there and there, but there are also differences. And I really would like to hear your opinion. Where do you see the differences and the similarities. Because I think for it's very important to discuss this. I hear it also in the media and the news. As you know, as a researcher, I'm researching Holocaust memory for decades now. There are some dangerous comparisons. What is your opinion concerning this?
So I'll say the similarities are in the hatred that fueled the atrocities of 10/7, in anti-Semitism. The same anti-Semitism, and we just touched upon some of it, the same anti-Semitism that fueled the atrocities, the war crimes, the crimes against humanity, on which 3,000 plus barbaric savages that infiltrated the state of Israel on that day were raised and educated. Mm-hmm. The same anti-Semitism that fueled those atrocities is the anti-Semitism that fuels the responses to those atrocities that are silent, that deny, that justify, that support, and that attack Jews around the world in the wake of atrocities perpetrated against Jews on 10/7.
Mm-hmm. Bystanders are bystanders.
Precisely right. Mm-hmm. You know, it was Elie Wiesel who actually, exactly. Right? So indifference is the opposite of love, not hatred, according to Elie Wiesel,
yes.
Right? And indifference.
Lack of empathy.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And standing idly by is actually never, or silence never, ever assists the tormented, only enables the tormentor. Now, if I say anti-Semitism, and we've used the word, you know, I'll say sort of loosely, because the truth is that anti-Semitism has a definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition.
IHRA.
The IHRA definition enables to identify and combat all strains of what I referred to before as an ever-mutating hatred, right? That has all kinds of examples. And the IHRA definition has 11 examples. And by the way, I explain to people all the time, it's a working definition. I say this with great pain, because sadly, as the oldest hatred in the world, as Professor Westrich used to call anti-Semitism, as the oldest hatred in the world, it will invariably mutate again. And we will have, if you will, to add example number 12 at the bottom of that list. But if we do not use the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism in order to be able to identify and combat all strains of what we identify as an ever-mutating viral hatred, and we only, you know, post-COVID, I can talk about viruses more easily. If we only identify and combat or inoculate our spaces and places from some strains of a virus, well, that's not going to be very helpful against the newer, modern, mainstream strain of the virus. And in this context, I want to say, and maybe this is where the similarities are, anti-Semitism, the fuel, and where the differentiation will begin. Mm-hmm. Anti-Zionism, or the negation of Israel's very right to exist, is the new, modern, mutated strain of anti-Semitism. If we don't recognize that, we can't combat and identify, or identify and combat, rather, anti-Semitism comprehensively. That is what has enabled, from the 1975 Zionism as Racism resolution in the UN, Soviet propaganda, actually alive and well on 2024 university campuses.
Everywhere in the West.
Zionism is racism is the beginning. And that's why I say it's a decades-long process. Yeah. If you demonize Zionism and Zionists, and I want to remind us, Zionism is indeed a 140-plus-year-old progressive national liberation movement that enabled the return of that prototypical indigenous people to their nation state, to the state of Israel, and ancestral homeland. Mm-hmm. But Zionism, or the word Zion, is actually a thousands of year old identity in which all of our ancestors, again, we just referred to the text we read on Passover, longed and yearned and prayed to return
to Zion
and Jerusalem. Exactly. And the understanding that you can turn Zionism into racism and then Israel into an apartheid state. The 2001 Durban Conference Against Racism turned into the most virulent anti-Semitic
this
hate fest you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Zionism is racism. 2001, Israel is an apartheid state. We have to remember the beginning of the process, of a long democratic process to create the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, is precisely after that 2001 Durban Conference Against Racism, when international law and human rights advocates recognized that their life's work was weaponized, co-opted and weaponized, including Bob Bernstein and others, co-opted and weaponized in order to demonize, delegitimize, and apply double standard, the mechanism, the similarity that we can talk about, right, that fuels that what we saw in 10/7. And the understanding that the 2001 Durban Conference Against Racism also began 23 years of Israel apartheid weeks on every single campus. There have been 23 years of Israel apartheid weeks on every campus. And I just want to add the last piece.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And the last piece of similarity we're living through right now. And that's where I'll move into the differentiation, if you will. The understanding that in the most Orwellian inversion of fact and of law, genocide itself and the Holocaust itself has been co-opted and weaponized in this systematic co-opting and weaponization of international law principles and mechanisms and understandings.
This is the revision of history.
And the understanding that genocide, and we have to remember this, genocide coined alongside crimes against humanity, genocide was coined by Raphael Lemkin, whose entire family was murdered in the Holocaust. Right. Raphael Lemkin then went to great lengths to create
escape
what we know
Auschwitz.
Of 100% and spent the rest of his life on the Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. And in the most Orwellian inversion of fact and of law, that is what the ICJ received from the complainant, none other than South Africa, Durban Conference Against Racism, South Africa, against the State of Israel, committing or alleging that the State of Israel in that Orwellian inversion is committing genocide, even as it defends itself from a genocidal terror organization committed in its charter to the annihilation of Israel and the murder of Jews. And here we move into the differentiation. 10/7 happened in 2023. And as I said at the UN, and as I've said to many of the university presidents, including some of those that appeared in Congress lately, 2023 is not 1943. Neither is 2024 1944. We have a nation state to which we returned as an indigenous people. We have sovereignty. We have a defense force. And we have a little...
But on October 7th, Jews were not protected by this sovereignty.
You are right.
This is the...
That is the multi-generational
the problem
trauma.
Where are we at?
You're 100% right. And on October 7th, not only were Jews not protected here in the attack, in Be'eri, in Nir Oz, in all of the yeshuvim across Israel, and actually
hiding in
all
the closet
of Israel, and we fail to mention now the tens of thousands of Israelis displaced not only from their homes in the south, but in the north, because we said Hamas is but one proxy of that murderous Islamic regime in Iran, alongside the Houthis and Hezbollah and so on.
But sovereignty, where's the sovereignty?
The understanding that that sovereignty was intentionally broken, because that's what terror does, right? Terror undermines trust. Terror creates despair
and fear
and lack of hope,
and lack of hope.
The lack of hope, the fear and the lack of hope. But where it is critical that we understand, and here I turn, of course, not just to Israel's friends and allies around the world, but to ourselves as well. The understanding that 2024 is not 1944, and we have that sovereignty, and we have an IDF, and we have a nation state. That comes with great responsibility. That comes with tremendous responsibility. And with a little more than half of the Jewish people here in Israel, and a little less than half in the rest of the world, primarily in the United States, the understanding that anti-Zionism, and I go back to that, the understanding that anti-Zionism as this new modern mainstream strain of anti-Semitism was also able to break us apart as a people, right? That Jews around the world actually, in many ways, are at the forefront of being able to sever that Zionist pound of flesh, if you will, in Shakespearean terms, shed that Zionist pound of flesh and be a good Jew. That's never worked out very well for us in the past, has it? And the understanding that the differentiation demands that we actually learn from our history so that never again means something, never again demands...
What does it mean for you?
Never again, first of all, is a prospect of commitment. Never again in the future, not never again in the past. When we focus on the Holocaust or singularly on Holocaust education, assuming that that is how we will prevent the recurrence of history, we do a great disservice to never again. Never again, prospect of commitment of never again demands that we understand the mechanism that enabled genocide, which Raphael Lemkin coined, and to describe the atrocities of the Holocaust, too terrible to imagine, not too terrible to have happened. Because never again relied on the fact that we will identify the entire systematic dehumanization, delegitimization, double standards. It's what makes the IRA working definition so critical at this very moment, not only for university presidents and for mayors and for law enforcement mechanisms, for the state of Israel. The IRA working definition of anti-Semitism is actually our responsibility, including, by the way, I'll say universities in the state of Israel that may not even know what the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism is. It's a working definition because it is a resource that enables to identify and combat the process, so that never again means And by the way, we live in a world of again and again. The mechanism of demonization and delegitimization and double standards has enabled Rwanda after the never again prospect of commitment was made by the UN, by that infrastructure created so that never again. It enabled murder now in Sudan that is systemic and systematic. It enables again and again, if you actually think that what you are preventing is the manifestation of that 10 mm-hmm. years of pro, tens mm-hmm. of years of process. We just described it, mm-hmm. right? I said 1975, Zionism is racism. 2001, Durban Conference Against Racism. 2023, Israel mm-hmm. committing genocide. That's a very long process of demonization, delegitimization, double standards. If we enable that process, we're not going to be able to prevent what happens at the end, right? When I spoke on the 75th anniversary of the Convention for the Prevention of the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, excuse me, in the German mission to the UN, mm-hmm. the representatives of Rwanda was there. The genocide in Rwanda didn't happen overnight. It happened after the same mechanism.
So what you're saying, never again, if I understand you right, means to acknowledge to first see the first signs in the process prior to genocides, to massacre, and to identify the red signs. The red signs.
100%.
This is what it means. So what were the questions that we didn't ask that led to October? So what were the concerns? We see the rise of anti-Semitism. It's crazy what's happening right now, not only in campuses. You walk in the street in Berlin, in London, in Paris, in New York, not just in campuses, you know, it's a scandal what's happening there. Are there questions that we have not asked? What have we missed, Michal?
Oh, yeah.
Regarding?
There are questions we haven't asked.
Anti-Semitism.
So the understanding that there is an unconventional war that has been raging for decades. Okay, I'm going to say anti-Semitism, I call it a predictive example of what it is that challenges that entire infrastructure. Okay, right mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. anti-Semitism is raging, as you said, across campuses, on the streets,
everywhere.
On social media, in parliaments, across the world, in a social media era in which polarization and fragmentization is part and parcel of our reality.
And it's being mainstreamed. It's not only a problem of the margins.
There you just said it.
It's politicized.
Why is the process so important? The decades of the process of those three Ds, the demonization, delegitimization, double. Why is it so important? Because that is what normalizes, right? If Zionism is indeed racism.
Normalization of hate.
If Israel mm-hmm. is an apartheid state, if Israel commits genocide,
then
Israel has no right to exist.
Exactly.
It is justified. And the normalization, right? Resistance is justified on GW, on George Washington University campus, at Harvard,
this
at
is
Columbia.
What the students
resistance
call
is
justified. For. Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And there's, and by they the way, really believe they are right.
And I'll say, not just the students. You hear Judith Butler explaining that rape mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. actually is armed resistance. Judith Butler, okay, radical, but feminist, who I studied when I was in law school, explaining that rape is armed resistance is an Orwellian inversion that took decades. And it is the normalization of anti-Semitism. And I want to say, what we missed is that, you know, Jews, for thousands of years, have just been the canary in the coal mine. But ultimately, the fact that the canary dies doesn't mean the coal mine won't collapse. And we are at
the Holocaust was an example.
Yes.
That the murder of Jews brought to murder of tens of millions of non-Jews.
Just one example.
In the end.
Just one example throughout history.
Yeah.
Just one example. And the thing that people miss over and over again is that, again, that's why the never again is we look for signs that will repeat themselves mm-hmm. in the exact same way. That's why
they They don't.
History doesn't repeat itself in the exact same way. It rhymes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It rhymes. Yes, so we have to understand the process that enables history to recur without looking for the exact same thing. That's why the politicization of anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. right? People talk to
each
me.
Each side uses it as a weapon mm-hmm. to the other side,
exactly.
to kill the other side.
So people, you know, on the left say, but the extreme right. Well, guess what?
It's on the extreme right and the extreme right. It's on the extreme left.
Forget what?
It's in the center. We know.
So the thing is that according to the extreme right, Jews will not replace us. You and I will never be white enough.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the radical left, you and I are hyper white. And according to the radical Islamists, it doesn't matter. Mm. And the point is that what binds all those together is not just that they are radical or extreme.
What binds
it's
them?
It's anti-Semitism.
It's hate.
It is hate. But it's again, that's why anti-Semitism, I say, is just predictive. Mm-hmm. It's not just hate against us. If we were to zoom out from 10-7, and I intentionally call it 10-7, mm-hmm. because it actually doesn't just elicit the intergenerational trauma that I referred to before. Mm-hmm. It elicits precisely the same threat of 9-11. Like 9-11, 10-7 was not just an attack on Israel. We may be at the forefront of this war, or on Jews around the world attacked as a result of these war crimes, crimes against humanity mm-hmm. perpetrated by genocide organization.
Mm-hmm. So what was
We have to understand 10-7 in this continuum of an alignment or a realignment of an axis of evil that is empowered by the fact that we do not see the connection between 10-7 and 9-11, that we do not see the connection between Iran, that Islamic authoritarian regime that does to its people the very same things that happened on 10-7. Mm-hmm. Literally, it's mm-hmm. not just our intergenerational trauma, rapes and poisons Yay. And executes and abducts yeah. mm-hmm. its own people. Yeah. But it's not just Iran. You watch what is happening with Putin's Russia and you see this continued understanding that if the West is very busy holding on to the differentiations of yesterday, right and left, religious and secular.
We're not there anymore.
Borders. We are not there.
We're not there anymore.
What 10-7 was an attack of barbarism on civilization. Mm-hmm. Anybody who in the name of progress cannot, in the name of progress, it's regress. That's not just, it's like beyond middle age regress. Anybody
People demonstrating in the University of Columbia think they are talking in the name of progress.
You are 100%
right. This is the problem.
But that
progress for them is free Palestine
but,
from the river to
but
the sea.
That is the result and also the opportunity where you ask me for the differentiation. That is the result of decades of the systematic co-opting and weaponization of that international rules-based order created so that never again. Of the human rights mechanisms. Well, here's the most important differentiation that I see, and it's why I keep getting on planes to go abroad as well. Mm-hmm. The most important understanding that we have at this critical moment is not just of the security threat to the state of Israel and to Jews around the world, but that this is a national security threat to any society that cherishes life
democracy.
And liberty.
Yeah.
And I'll say not even to just to liberal democracies, to any society that cherishes life and liberty, meaning we would be remiss if we didn't think of the Abraham Accord countries in this context as well. Societies that have chosen life and liberty,
correct.
If you will, have chosen hope over death, mm-hmm. over glorification of terror, over the glorification of murder. Societies that have chosen that are at a critical moment of understanding that actually the many masks brutally removed on 10-7 have to be connected. And that's why I say this axis of evil I mentioned, Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, the understanding that there is this momentous opportunity for democracies, and not just for democracies, to recognize that everything that we have built, because we cherish life and liberty, has been acknowledged as weaknesses of democracy to undermine them. Hmm. That's what this is about, right? Iran says clearly, because the thing with authoritarian regimes is that they say what they mean and they mean what they say. You just have to follow
true.
Their Twitter feeds.
True.
Very clearly, the intention is not just the state of Israel. And by the way, the university campus students at Columbia say the same thing. When I was at Stanford recently to give a talk, the university students that were demonstrating against my talking on campus about anti-Semitism with the president, with the provost, in an audience of hundreds of people, was actually, when we're done with Israel, we're going to dismantle the United States of America. They say what they mean, and they mean what they say.
Yes.
This is about the undermining of democratic values.
Happening. Yes.
And that's also the opportunity. That's where this is different.
This is exactly what I want to what I want to ask you. What do you think is, if there is a role for the state of Israel in combating anti-Semitism, what is the role? Because sometimes too much intervening might also harm. I know that some people in Jewish communities also say sometimes, don't intervene too much because it harms us when you're too much involved. So what is the right
line? I'll say, and I'll start by saying this. I'm a member of a coalition of special envoys for combating anti-Semitism.
Yes.
I have colleagues in the United States and Canada, across Europe and South America. But I am Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism. And Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. And the first thing that needs to happen is for this to be recognized as what I just said, and we sort of glossed over it. This is an unconventional war for public opinion that's been raging for decades.
A war, not
a
less.
A war, not less. And we have not treated it as a war front. And this front, I call it the eighth front, okay? People talk about the seven fronts, and we're now, you know, fighting on six or seven fronts already after April 14th, right? Because Iran actually attacked us directly. The eighth front will actually impact all the other, and our ability to fight on all the other fronts. And why do I say that?
The international front.
The unconventional war for public opinion. International in that it has raged and is raging in the international institutions, right? UNRWA, the UN, the ICC, the ICJ. That's the mechanism that we're created for so that never again, but demonized, delegitimized, and apply double standards to systematically in those mechanisms. The Jew among the nations has actually been mainstreamed in terms of the anti-Semitism against or anti-Zionism against that Jew among the nations. Same with university campuses, same with social media spaces. And we didn't even talk about the fact that we live in a digital reality and what the implication is for an unconventional war for public opinion raging.
So the censorship in social media. Everybody can post whatever they want and it's okay. And it reaches hundreds of millions of people in the split of a second.
And you don't even know who it is
and you
that's
don't even know
sharing the information,
you
right?
You can't reach him.
So the understanding that
this is social media.
The same lack of transparency on campuses, right? We now know there are billions of Qatari dollars in American universities. Again, this did not happen overnight. Well, guess what? The same dollars can buy you a lot of mileage on social media
If only you post platforms. What we tell you.
And or if you're not a person, right? The understanding that there are state sponsors of terror that are sowing the same hatred and fear and distrust and despair on every one of those mechanisms. And so when you come back and ask me, what is the state of Israel's role as that nation state of an indigenous people returned after millennia of exile and persecution committed to equality? That's not me. That's Israel's Declaration of Independence. It's actually to renew the commitment to that Declaration of Independence as we usher in our 76th year of existence and our fourth quarter of life as that modern nation state. To recognize that this is a part of the unconventional war that has been raging for decades after a series of conventional wars from 1948 to 1973 failed to destroy the state of Israel. And this unconventional war, and I said, Soviet propaganda, right? Zionism is racism. Israel's an apartheid state. Israel's perpetrating genocide. That's not new. That's good old Soviet propaganda, alive and well on university campuses in the name of progress, as you said before, not progressive at all, actually regressive.
In their minds, they think they're progressive.
But the role of Israel is actually to recognize that as a war front.
But what does it mean to recognize and, take it to action? What does it mean? To make an alliance? If Israel is alone in this.
I don't think that Israel is alone in this. I said that there are places in which we have to transcend and reach across difference of geography and religion and politics.
Only problem of Jews.
Oh no, it is certainly not just a problem of Jews. We can see it now across the world. But I want to explain what I mean by engaging in this unconventional war for public opinion as a war front. You know, a war defined in Israel that has been fighting for its life, literally for its existence. On very physical war fronts with tanks and planes and bullets, we understand those war fronts. The acknowledgement that this unconventional war is raging as actually a strategic threat
to
the state of Israel,
don't
fight it with tanks. And that means that the state itself has to, as it has on every other war front, prepare, create an authority with authority, because it's nice that I'm Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism. But this needs to be a collaborative strategy with authority to execute, just like we do on every other war front that includes security organizations, that includes all the ministries, that includes decision makers of the highest level, that includes a budget. Literally understanding, because that we are in a war and we are now in a reactive mode. I call it whack-a-mole, especially in a social media reality, right? We want to remove content. That's not going to help. Every time
A bandage on.
Completely. Yeah. It's like exactly right. It's like putting a bandage. And at this point, it's not even like putting a bandage because
on
we
a
know
bleeding.
Billions of people have already seen it, even by the time content is removed.
No, it doesn't matter. Not efficient.
If we do not create a holistic strategy that addresses and that combats this war, and I leave it to have a further discussion and where I believe that has to be, but it has to begin with the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. In every place and space, it's how I begin and end every meeting that I have with a second gentleman about the national strategy in the United States. That doesn't include singularly the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism. It has alongside it another definition, the nexus, mm-hmm. that doesn't enable to identify and address exactly the strain of anti-Semitism that has become mainstream at Columbia and at every other campus across the United States. One more piece is the understanding that, and you asked me about this, this is a critical moment for coalition building. No subject of hatred all of history of any racism or bigotry can fight it alone. Neither can Jews, the subject of the hatred of anti-Semitism. We will not be able to fight this alone. And where 2024 is not 1944, is at the very least, for the first time in our own history, mm-hmm. never again for us, has to mean that we will reach out and transcend real or perceived differences of politics and geography and religion in order to build coalitions that for the first time in Jewish history enable us to not only lean in to this covenant of faith that Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke of. Mm-hmm. Why covenant of fate? Because the hate will define that we are bound together and united. No. For the first time in history, we have the opportunity, and I'll say the obligation, to lean into the covenant of destiny and understand that this is a part and parcel of the free world. Yeah. This
is a part
and parcel.
We have partners, though. We're not alone. Maybe this is really the biggest difference.
100%.
We're not in 1944.
We're not in 1944. Yeah. But that comes with a great deal of responsibility. It doesn't just, and with a great deal of depoliticization, including of anti-Semitism, and calling out any attempt to politicize anti-Semitism. From the right to say I see it on the left. From the left to say I see it on the right. From Islamists to say I see it from Islam. No, the radical, and that's exactly why we have a definition. It doesn't matter for me where it comes from. Very same definition exactly. that unites and actually holds us to a greater level of responsibility than ever before in Jewish history, in that we have come to this moment where at the very least we can fight back and we can ensure that never again means never again will we allow the process of demonization and delegitimization and double standards. It doesn't mean
because we know where it leads.
Exactly right. It doesn't mean that we will be able to prevent additional attacks on Jews around the world. It means that we have to do our very best to ensure that we have fought this in a way that never in Jewish history have we had the chance to do.
Michal Kotel-Wunsch, thank you so much for coming today, for enlightening us on such an important burning topic, anti-Semitism. And also the Holocaust memory remembrance and how it will all affect on preserving Holocaust memory. I think also time will tell us how it will all evolve. Thank you so much for your contribution today in the talk. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Adi. And I'll just say one final sentence for our listeners to remember, please, the State of Israel does not exist because the Holocaust occurred. It's precisely the opposite. A Holocaust could not have occurred had the State of Israel existed. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you to our viewers and listeners. See you in the next program.